coming. So this book, Swim, is 4 years in the making. And I wanted today to talk a little bit about where the idea for the Swim book came from, and then take you through how you discover stories of something that is so everyday and common in New Zealand that nothing has ever been written about it before. So I was a keen swimmer as a child, as most New Zealand children are, and swam at any place that I could encounter. I swam all through my teens and 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, started to slow down a bit, and then one day I found myself sitting on the bank and watching my kids swim, and I didn't get in. And I had this appalling memory of old people when I was seven, parents sitting on the riverbank and not getting in the water. And I did not want to be one of those dusty, dry adults. So I made a commitment to myself to get in the water. And I'm a strategist by trade. That's what I do for a living. And you can't be a strategist without having some numbers and figures in mind. So, you know, what did a lot of swimming mean? And I decided that it meant swimming every day, all summer, outdoors, somewhere outdoors. And that's how this got underway. So I did swim all summer. I loved it. And it's warm at the end of summer, so I carried on swimming all through autumn. And by the end of autumn, it's cold and you're used to it, so I carried on all through winter. And the next thing, I'd swum every day for a year. And I discovered in that year, or rediscovered, how important swimming is to New Zealanders. And I'd like to read you a short piece from the book. Let's find it. Jenny Landreth says that everyone has a water biography, a history of water memories. Given our richly watered islands, this must be especially true for New Zealanders. We swam our landscapes as children, slipping in and out of lakes, creeks, pools, rivers, bogs, estuaries, rock pools, the edge of the Pacific Ocean, the Tasman Sea, the Straits. Wherever we drove or picnicked or camped or visited, we kids would find the water. Breathing in the old green smell of rivers, or drifting downward through the heavy layers of lake water, or floating inches above the snail-tracked mud on rising estuarine tide, or grabbing handfuls of sand deep beneath fizzing salty waves, or getting headaches from ominously cold waterholes, we were drenched and enlivened and absorbed in every landscape if we could enter it through the water. Later, sleepless in a hot house at night, we relived our day, diving again and again into the same water until the swimming memories became waterscapes of belonging, and we recognised our swimming places in the same way galaxids and eels must find their way back to their water sources through smell and taste and some inchoate feeling of belonging. It was 4 years' work to find those stories that somehow represented and captured New Zealand. And I found that during the year, wherever I went, my rule was to swim where as far as I was from home in that day. So I was very often swimming in strange landscapes, and I had to approach local people to find out where they swam. And they would be interested in what I was up to and start telling me stories. And I started to collect these stories and started to track them and follow them. And in my meetings for my work, I would always ask during the meeting, how many swimmers are there? Who swims in this room? Because I wanted to find people and talk to them later. And very few people would put their hands up. And I used to think this was odd until I realised that to say you swim sounds athletic. It sounds like you're into, you know, swimming up and down lengths and getting in races. And I learned to say, who likes to take a dip? And everybody's hands would go up. Who likes to take a dip here? Good, yes. And so that's how I really started to break into it and realise that very little has been captured about this fantastic pastime of New Zealanders. There's books about togs, fashion, swimming fashion. There's books about beaches. There's some about swimming as a sport, but there is nothing specifically about swimming in our landscapes. This particular book does include contemporary stories. It's got story interviews with swimmers from all over New Zealand, contemporary photos and so on. But I thought today, because these are the heritage talks, that I would take a heritage angle to my talk and focus on the history component of the book and how I discovered some of those old stories. And one of the acknowledgements in the back of the book is actually to the librarians of Auckland Council Libraries and the councillors who approve their budgets. Together they maintain an incredible resource of written material that has inspired and informed many of the stories in this book. And I really did want to acknowledge the librarians because they have been absolutely fabulous and really enthusiastic about this subject and dragged all sorts of material out from the depths of the place and introduced me to various things I would not have otherwise found. And we live right out in West Auckland. I could order almost any book that's ever been written in New Zealand or anywhere and it would be delivered to my local library. Just fabulous. So I'm very, very grateful to Auckland Libraries. So the first place I looked when I was looking for historic photos, historic stories, was Papers Past. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with this. This is the digitalisation of 68 million newspaper articles in New Zealand from 1839 through to 1950. It also has 377 magazines and journals. So you put search, you search swim in that huge resource. I got 160,000 references. If you search for bathing, I got 354,000 references. So I wasn't going to be able to read all of those, but I just started to delve in. And after a while, themes started to emerge, and the stories started to emerge. So a lot of hits on the early Paper Past were about swimming competitions, right back from as early as the 1860s. And I started to see some, unexpectedly, some famous international names of Olympians who had visited New Zealand. They came out by steamship, they toured New Zealand for 6 weeks to 3 months, and then they left and went on to Australia or to the next country. And I was fascinated to read the fixation that early New Zealand settlers had, particularly with these famous swimmers. And quite a few of the stories in the book came from this. This man, Duke Kahanamoku, was an internationally famous swimmer from Hawaii. He learned to swim as a small boy by being thrown into the Honolulu harbour from an outrigger canoe by his uncles. As a young man, he shocked officials by smashing local swimming records, and from there he swam his way into history. He became a five-time Olympian medalist in swimming, and at one time holding every freestyle record up to half a mile. He eventually lost his gold medal winning run to Johnny Weissmuller, the actor who went on to play Tarzan, and he joked that it took Tarzan to beat him. His traditional overarm flutter kick swimming style contributed to the development of the freestyle stroke and was imitated by all swimmers who watched him. So this was in the very early 1900s. At the time, pākehā swimmers in New Zealand were either swimming breaststroke or this contorted thing called the trudgeon, which is actually, I think, based on an era of observation of indigenous swimming by a British guy, Mr. Trudgeon, who saw an indigenous swimming style overarm but couldn't see what the legs were doing and imagined that it was a sort of scissor kick thing from a breaststroke. So he combined the two and insisted that this was the fastest way to swim, and that a lot of the pākehā swimmers in New Zealand were doing the trudgeon. And when they saw the Duke, this magnificent Hawaiian Pacific Islander in New Zealand, Māori in New Zealand already had a freestyle, but of course it took somebody from overseas to really show us how to do it. Everybody started to copy the Duke. So he was called the Duke, that was his nickname. He was also credited of reigniting the ancient Pacific sport of surfing to the Western world. Māori surfed, but it had gone into somewhat of abeyance until the Duke just put the spotlight back on it. In 1917, he's most famous in Hawaii for riding one of the longest waves in surfing history, a bluebird, on his 16-foot, 52-kilo wooden surfboard for nearly a kilometre. So he came to New Zealand, and New Zealand was smitten with the fellow. The Dominion reported that he was a product of the surf that beats eternally on the picturesque beach of Waikiki, the home of surf, the surf bather and the breaker shooter. Truth newspaper declared, as a man of the ancient Greeks and Romans, he is perfect. He was tall, over 6 foot, broad-shouldered, long-limbed and handsome. Wildly beating hearts needed to be stilled all over the country. It was reported that in lieu of a speech at receptions, he played his ukulele. And 3,000 people crowded Auckland's Calliope Wharf, a dock, in a glorious weather to watch him race in 1915 when he came. He swam in Hamilton to a packed stadium who declared they'd had the experience of a lifetime seeing him. Passed through Palmerston North by train, gave an exhibition of swimming at the local bars, and then on to Wellington. And at Christchurch and Hokitika, they had about 1,000 people come to see him. So that was one theme, and I followed through quite a few of the stories of those international swimmers who came to New Zealand. Movies was another theme that emerged early on. So the movies, this particular woman, Annette Kellerman, you may have heard of her. All these names are so familiar to me now, I think everybody knows Annette Kellerman. So she was a Australian swimmer in the 1920s, 1910s and 1920s, the first to introduce the one-piece bathing suit for women, and she was arrested for indecent exposure as a result of that, and she was known throughout the world. She was also a vaudeville swimmer, which was a sort of a mix of underwater showmanship and synchronised swimming all rolled into one. Fantastic stories of the impact. All through papers past, I searched her name once I found it and discovered these marvellous stories. So I want to read you a little bit about the impact that she had in New Zealand. She was described in 1921 by the Christchurch Press as the world's most perfectly formed woman. And when she was here, she was, quote, at the zenith of her fame. She was here for 6 months. The Otago Daily Times reported that she carried her huge audience in that town by storm. They were marvelling at the grace of her underwater movements. The press reported that the Theatre Royal was filled to overflowing. So what she was doing was swimming in a glass tank with 700 gallons of water in it on stage. The press declared Christchurch audiences are notoriously cold, or at least undemonstrative, no matter what their actual feelings may be. But at the Theatre Royal on Saturday night, they let themselves loose and gave a royal reception, not only to Miss Kellerman, but to her entire company. So she declared during that time she was going to make a movie about swimming in New Zealand. This is in the silent movie times, very famous movies being made all over the world. They chose Nelson, much to the thrill of the local people. They said that the water, the movie director said the clarity of the water in Nelson for sea scenes rivaled that of the West Indies, while the golden sands across the bay are considered to be the finest in the world for photographic purposes. Nelson held their breath. They were expecting to get very, very rich and famous from this movie. In 1922, the great entourage arrived. It included cameramen, laboratory men, submarine diving experts, a diving bell weighing 3 tons, 50,000 feet of negative film, a chemical spotlight, and a parabolic mirror that produced 1 million candle power to fire everything up. There was a fleet of sailing ships and a complete hospital outfit and staff, together with 2 doctors. 12 tons of scenery were brought in by boat. A huge arc lamp was mounted at the reservoir on a 7.5-metre-high platform lit by a dynamo. For the star herself, a gown with 1,000 hand-sewn pearls was made for the undersea sequences. So I followed through over the entire year reading newspaper accounts. Nobody could get a word out of me. My work and business fell to pieces while I researched Annette Kellerman and the 1922 movie all the way through. And eventually you started to see the movie was advertised, and then we started to get some reviews in. They were absolutely ecstatic about this marvellous movie, and Nelson never did get particularly famous out of it, but New Zealanders were thrilled to be honoured in this way. So you can still watch Venus of the South Seas. There's this little clip of it online if you want to, or you can go into the Sound and Ngā Taonga Sound Archives, and sit behind a little desk and a computer screen and put the earphones on and watch the whole thing. It's fabulous. It's completely fabulous. Okay, so the next source of material beyond papers past that I started to look at were historic journals. That you can't actually research bathing or swimming, or very little of that is digitalised. You actually have to sit down and read these. Auckland Library holds quite a few, but I also went to wherever I was in New Zealand, I went to the local library and looked at their local, those little pamphlets that people put out, like, you know, the People's History of Faux, or the, you know, wherever you are. Marvellous places, but you do read an awful lot of backstory, and suddenly you'll come across a story about swimming. One of the themes that emerged and has ended up as a chapter in the book is stories about damming the local creek. So I'm going to read you a short extract from the Ohinemuri Regional History Journal. This is from somebody's memoirs called Jack Milroy. He was recalling his early 1900s childhood. He described how a lack of decent-sized swimming holes in the local Rahu Creek prompted some of the older boys to organise working bees to make a dam across the creek. And this is his memory. Each family had to bring along at least 4 sacks. These were filled with clay from the bank and laid across and backed up with stones to hold them against the weight of the water. Boys and girls of all sizes joined in, and the result was a fine and, to us children, very large swimming pool that lasted the whole summer. This is where we all learned to swim. After the floods of winter, the dam had to be renewed for the next summer. And another memory from someone called Laddie Walker from another local history was that each of these dams had a name: Smith's, Irwin's, Roach's, O'Neill's, and whichever one you helped to build, you had membership of for the summer. So that those memories of the local swimming pools made in run-of-the-river creeks were highlighted in the 1930s with the make-work schemes during the Depression to employ unemployed men. And one of them I found an account of at Otapapa Creek in Carmore, which is near Whangarei. And that particular creek in 1931 was built by labour from unemployed men. It lasted till 1949 when a small boy fell in and drowned, and the local men were grief-stricken and blew it up. So one day when I was in Whangarei, I was set off to find this place, and people had no memory of it whatsoever. So I found the Otapapa Creek, and it was at the back of the local tennis courts at Carmore, and fought my way down through this bush. It was all overgrown, and I saw the creek at the bottom. I got down to the creek, I walked along the creek, and it's just moss and ferns, and suddenly my feet were on a step. And I looked down, and there were the steps disappearing down into the creek. And I looked around a bit further. I could see the remnant of an old wall. It was thrilling. It was quite thrilling. It was just a story that I had come across first in a magazine quite randomly, and then here was evidence of it.
How do you spell
Otapapa? Otapapa. Books were another source. Fiction. There's some beautiful fiction passages. I don't actually have a copy the time, so I should have actually. Yeah, thank you. Give me 5 minutes before the end. But Janet Frame is one of my favourite quotes about swimming. I just have to tell you, because who could beat this? This is from her book Living in the Maniatoto. I kept thinking of the summers where we spent all day at the swimming baths and the beach, and our hair was never dry. The strands were matted with salt, and we felt that we were fish rather than children. Our bathing suits rolled up in their towels, there was a special way of parceling up your togs, were forever wet. Our bare feet forever made wet prints. Our eyelashes were so wet we had to keep blinking as if through tears. And the taste when we licked our lips or sucked imaginary snake poison from our arm was salty and strong. Those were days of shivering and warmth, of opposing weathers without gradation. She really captures it. Morris G, Bruce Mason, there are others who have incorporated swimming into their fiction. Non-fiction. Non-fiction was particularly important for discovering old Māori stories, including Alston Best and other Pākehā memories and stories about what they witnessed, but also the Waitangi Tribunal reports and early the landmarks of iwi, because for iwi, the rivers and lakes, the sea, the estuaries, all of those watery places are an essential part of being and who they are, important points of belonging. So for the Māori, the contemporary Māori that I interviewed for this book, they all talked about swimming landscapes of belonging, and beautifully evocative. There were also books that actually record landmarks of iwi. This Māori, the native swing, which, you know, I don't know if you've seen this picture before, it's quite a famous illustration. I never thought before that what they're actually doing is swinging out over the river, over the water and into the lakes. Very brave, hugely high. They swung out a long, long way. And there were places that are recorded on the Whanganui River, also in Tūhoe country, around Waikaremoana, around the lakes of Rotorua, probably everywhere in New Zealand, where these spots are named. They have a name, and each of those Māori have a name. And it's all about just the sheer joy of throwing yourself into the water. It's gorgeous. One of the lovely stories I came across is told to me by Willie Wright from Te Uri Aho. Māori have the most extraordinary swimming stories. First swimmers across Cook Strait, they swam for miles, they were just brilliant, and still are today. But one example I loved was Te Hana, who was a beautiful woman who lived on the Potu Peninsula in the 1600s. She swam across the treacherous mouth, or near the mouth of the Kaipara Harbour, can you imagine it, to her love, and her love's name was Rangi Whā Papa, and it resulted in a war that saw the expulsion of Ngāti Awa from the Kaipara Harbour, although that's Te Uri Aho's version of the story. And Te Hana, which is the little settlement on State Highway 1 north of Auckland, it's named after that swim and that woman. So that was the other thing I discovered. The names of places were, or many, many places in New Zealand, were about swimming. School journals, I absolutely loved these. Probably most of you in the room will remember them. Marvellous, marvellous resource. So I went in just the old research room that was here and asked them to bring me school journals. And up they came and all the trolleys and just thump on the desk. I spent day after day and I just got completely distracted in many, many stories. But many of them feature swimming. Because they are for children and they are trying to write about things that they think that children will enjoy reading, I really did lead to a problem of over-research. I found Barry Mitcalf swimming with a seal story called Let Him Go, marvellous, evocative story about a boy who befriends a seal at Kaikoura and goes swimming with him every day. And one of Daring Do from World War II by M.J. Mason, and he's escaping from German capture by diving into a flooded river. And you can't actually, you can't photocopy the old school journals because it would harm the binding. So I took photos of them and I transcribed this entire story. It was thousands of words long because I was going to have it in my book one way or another. And I kept seeing that it was going to be too long. So every edition of the book, it shrank and it shrank and it shrank and it shrank until it was down to a paragraph. And I knew what was behind that paragraph. It's a marvellous story. The Germans are standing there shooting into the flooded river. He dives in and swims for his life and nearly drowns, and he comes out the other side, and then he gets saved by the local Italian family, and he gets pneumonia, and he nearly dies. I just wanted the whole thing in my book. And I got to the last remaining paragraph and sent off to the copy editor, and she said, it's got to go. So cross that out. But there are other war stories that stayed. I don't quite know why that one didn't work. I still like that one. But so school journals were an amazing source. There's another woman that I overdid things with. This is Lily Copplestone, who's should be, you know, on one of our coins, I think. She's a very special person. So she was the first person to attempt to swim the Cook Strait. She's 1930s, and I discovered her just through reading the papers past newspaper clips of Googling, or not, but searching for the word swim. So she swam all over New Zealand, a very famous long-distance swimmer, very able swimmer, and she was also involved in the swimming, 1930s endurance swimming, like they had dancing, where they danced for 3 days and then half of them died, or tree sitting or bicycle riding. They had swimming. So, and we had a woman called Mercedes Glitz, who was a British woman at the time, came to New Zealand and did the first of these endurance swims. So Lily got into it, and there's some marvellous stories about that, which I can talk about later if we have time. Sometimes it was a photograph that triggered a piece of research, and I found this photograph online in the Te Ara, which is also a fantastic research place, full of stories of our New Zealand history. This photo prompted me to check newspapers and magazine references for swimming in the Crater Lake on Mount Ruapehu. And I found this marvellous story from 1924 in a newspaper. So I'll read you this. I discovered that one man carried a boat up the mountain so that he could be the first to swim across, but he didn't quite trust that he could do it, so he had someone in a rowboat following him. So this is, I discovered in 1924, from a newspaper article at the time, the headmaster of Ohakune School, who'd been taking some young boys up the mountain for a swim. The lake was then known, at least locally, as the Eighth Wonder of the World, one of the many natural attractions that jostled for this title. I think I found four or five Eighth Wonders of the World related to swimming in New Zealand. So here's the quote. Sometimes the hot water undermines the sea cliffs and huge pieces of the overhanging ice break off and thunder down into the cauldron with a roar followed by a hiss and clouds of steam, went a description of the lake at the time. With the smashing ice came a large wave that on one occasion soaked the clothing discarded on the scoria beach by the little boys who were swimming out to the lake. Making their way back to the school, the children would slide several thousand feet down the slopes of the mountain on sugar sacks. The headmaster always beat them back, though, because he was scooting down on a frying pan. Yeah. It was the headmaster. So sometimes one thing led to another in following the research. This is Violet Wolrond, beautiful young woman at 14, New Zealand's youngest Olympian. And she was a group of a young woman I called the Famous Five, who really broke open swimming as a possibility for women, especially young women, in the 1920s. Before that, very few women were even allowed to swim in races, and these five young women, unrelated, but they just something about that time sparked the whole thing. So they were swimming competitively, and eventually Violet ended up at the Olympic Games, and it's a marvellous story. It was in Brussels. It was snowing. She couldn't train because women weren't allowed to swim at the tepid baths. Her father wouldn't take her training, so she did not train at all. And when she got there, she wasn't allowed in the Olympics, so her father went to all the races and she sat behind in the hotel room. He wasn't a very nice fellow. He eventually stopped her career because I think he was jealous of her. But she went in the actual race. She came fifth in the final, I think, third in one of the heats, but was swimming in the canals. The swimming Olympics was in the canals, which were oily and filthy and freezing cold. There were no lanes marked, no goggles were allowed, they didn't have them. So very special. But in researching that group of women, I discovered a linked story of a woman called Pauline Hoft, who was one of her competitors. Pauline, every one of those women I followed all the way through to the end of their lives. I even tried to find their death certificates. I was absolutely over-researched. But this is a marvellous story about a Pacific link to swimming. So Pauline went on when she retired from competitive swimming as a young woman in New Zealand to Tonga, which was her home country, to an island called Niuafo'u. It has no natural harbour. So passing schooners could not, this is in the 1920s, so passing schooners could not safely come ashore to make deliveries. Nor, because of the island's steep cliffs, was it easy to set forth in canoes to collect the mail. Outriggers had to be thrown off the cliffs and the crew dive in after them and attempt to board in the big surf. So it was a problem to get the mail. At the turn of the century, the sailors tried delivering the mail to the island with rockets, but this proved unsatisfactory, with mail lost in the bush or falling short into the sea, or even on several occasions bursting into flame. Eventually, the local postmaster established a method whereby the mail was welded shut inside 40-pound ship biscuit tins and tossed overboard about a mile offshore to be retrieved by swimmers from the island. Because of the wild currents around the island, the swimmers could take up to 6 hours to reach their targets. So Pauline became one of those, they're called the tin can mail swimmers. If a ship had mail and it was passing by during the night, it would sound its siren and the swimmers would go out as a group. On shore, the villagers lit fires to guide the swimmers back in. In 1930, the method was abandoned after one of the swimmers was bitten by a shark and died. And how are we doing for time?
Fine.
I've got one more story then to tell you. And in this discovery of old stories, I found some names from my own childhood. Who remembers Dr. Turbot? Dr. Turbot's weekly... Oh, am I the oldest person in this room? Thank you. Dr. Turbot's weekly radio talks, which we used to eat breakfast by on Saturday mornings. And he always had, you know, descriptions of what to do in case the children had constipation or worms or, you know, very practical kind of sensible things. He had view about swimming. Swimming, he said in 1969, is one of the best recreations where exercise is fought for weight reduction. In addition, the body burns up more food as energy to counteract the loss of heat from cold water, and there is less left to be stored as fat. As well as energetic swimming, leisurely floating on the surface is healthy because of its soothing, relaxing effect. And Dr. Truby King, who started Plunkett, so you know him, so he had very strong views. Anything was a very strong view of... He said in 1929, "Have you ever noticed how dreadfully afraid of cold water most people are? That fear is a mystery to me. People will occasionally tell you that they can't stand it, that it's a shock to their nerves and all the rest of it. That sort of talk is twaddle. In all my experience, I have never yet known a person who shunned cold water that cold water would not have benefited. It hurts nobody." He put cold water swimming amongst the top 6 essentials for health. The others were fruit, raw vegetables, coarse bread, water drinking, and vigorous toweling down. Yes. He also prescribed cold water bathing to his staff and patients at Seacliff, which was what he called a lunatic asylum in Otago. He said it is a fact that children grow more in 1 month than a whole year at school if they bathe in cold seawater and play on the beach as much as possible. On a visit to Auckland schools in 1929, Truby King was surprised to discover that few children took cold swims in the morning. We know, he said, that the children of Otago and Southland tend to be hardier and more vigorous than those of the north. However, children of Auckland are not necessarily handicapped in this way. Given the priceless daily habit of cold water swimming, or at least a cold bath, followed by active exercise, and they could have almost all the advantages of the South without its rigors, discomforts, and restrictions. So, there's some stories from swim.
Following her talk, Annette was asked if her research had included anything about wharf jumping or jetty jumping, and she gave us an insight into manu bombing.
There's a chapter in here called manu bombing, which is the latest version of the cannonball. I wouldn't mind. Have I got a minute to try to find manu bombing? 65, and then, so manu bombing is Kiwi as, is it bombing, is a summer way of life in New Zealand. You can drop bombs into water anywhere, but the best leaps take place off the wharves and jetties where you can get high up above deep water. There's room for an audience to line up and admire your style, and there's a ladder for climbing back up, ready for the next jump. And I went down to try and find the manu bombers down at the wharf at Auckland, and they'd been shooed away by because one of those Volvo round the world yacht race was in town, so the manu bombers had all been taken away. But in Wellington, they've got a jump platform at Taranaki Wharf, and specially designed, and there's a marvellous piece which I would have liked to have put in the book, of the illustration from the architect of how to design the perfect bombing platform. So you've got a choice about how you jump and how you enter the water. They're very specific, these people, with each style having its own name. The pin, the gorilla, the coffin bomb, the knee bomb, the angel, where you spread your body out before tucking up to hit the water, and the more traditional cannonball, which we all grew up with. Of recent years, we have the manu, a bomb simulating a bird taking flight. A good manu bomber enters water in the perfect V, with legs and arms straight up and the tailbone or lower back entering the water first. An advanced version of the manu is to hold a rugby or a volleyball between your legs as you pop the manu, sending the ball tens of metres into the air when it hits the water. Manu bomber Charles Po'ona describes the technique. What my dad told me was, just before your feet hit the water, lean back, bro, and that's it. Tamati Makaere, whose ball manu bomb video clip from the Taranaki Wharf in Wellington has had over 500,000 hits online. That's how good it is, and it's a great bomb. You should look at it. A water bottle, I've seen them doing that too. So he says weight placement's a lot of it. And there is a manu expert who's my favourite, Dan Tahere, says manu bombing is not without its hazards. And here's his quote: although I've got a big bum, it does hurt hitting that water. Last year my shorts ripped open. It was just the right amount of pressure coming from a 10 metre high platform, and the velocity and the kinetic energy you build up coming down, something's got to give. Lucky it was the shorts. And there's now national bombing competitions, there's tournaments. The one last year was in Blue Lake at Te Kitapu. And they had the winning jump won $2,000. So it's a competitive sport now. So you can get out there and practice. They have an old people's category. Not to cast aspersions on the people in the room, but just saying.
Coming up next week, the South Auckland Poets Collective co-founders join curator Sharon Smith to talk about their new exhibition, South Auckland Poets Collective, The First 10 Years. The South Auckland Poets Collective, or SAPC, uses poetry to facilitate personal and social change. Opening 23rd of February at Māngere Arts Centre, the exhibition is a collaborative project between SAPC, Auckland Libraries, and Action Education. You can hear the talk on February 27th at 12 p.m. as part of our Heritage Talk series.